Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, Total Tutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And, you know, when I remember a really dominating offensive lineman, and as a huge Steeler fan, I remember this guy. We connected via social media, and I said, hey, I want to definitely have him on the program. So excited to welcome the program. Pro Bowl, national champion with the Miami Hurricanes, and I consider a super Steeler, Leon Searcy. Leon, thanks for calling, and how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, absolutely, Leon. And I tell you, it's just looking back and you look at your career and what you were able to accomplish in an offensive lineman, getting to play the 11 years in the pros, that's got to really be a great thing for you to think about, right? To know that you were able to stay that long in the NFL and play at such a high level, I think, for sure.
Well, you know, I enjoyed my time in the NFL. I played with some great players. I had some outstanding experiences. I had opportunity to play in the Super Bowl. I just enjoyed playing with great men. I was blessed to be around great men throughout my career with the Steelers. I mean, guys like Damani Dawson and Rod Woodson and Greg Lloyd and Carnell Lake. I mean, these are just great men that I looked up to, that had a lot to do with profound in my career as a Steeler. You know, basically they taught me how to be a man. You know, a lot of players come in from college and they come into the league, and just because they're making a whole bunch of money, you know, they think that they're grown and that they have the ability to be men. But yeah. I was blessed with guys around me, like those guys that I just mentioned, that those guys were the ultimate professionals. And it had a lot to do with the kind of success that it had as a Steeler.
And always for definitely our flagship station in Pittsburgh, we want to really kind of delve into the Steeler organization. All the former Steelers that I have on the program, just especially talk about how the camaraderie of the Steelers organization from the Rooneys on down. Isn't that true for sure? It sounds like that's the same thing what you learned from as well when you were
Yeah, it is. Well, it is. I have the utmost respect for the Rooney family. You know, they made the Steeler brand the recognizable brand that it is today. And the one thing I did enjoy about being a Steeler is that the guys on the team were family. I mean, the one thing that you can recognize about a team is that, and the team that's going to have success is that, you know, once practice is over, a lot of the guys spent time with one another, whether it was going out to dinner, going out to lunch, hanging with each other, maybe going to have a beer. So it was a profound family, and I think that had a lot to do with the amount of success that we had on the field and the fact that we had a coach. We had a personable coach who was a player's coach.
Yes.
And you would do everything you wanted. You would do everything that you needed to do throughout the week so that on Sunday you could shine. And Coach Cowell made sure of that. And he was just a great guy to play for.
Thinking about, you know, playing for the Hurricanes and then the Steelers, two traditions at that time that were unstoppable, you know, programs. It must have been awesome. You just kept winning, right? Pretty much from going from...
The one thing about playing for the Miami Hurricanes, going to a school like that, in the time and era that I played in, you know, my 5 years there, I won 3 national titles and only lost 4 games in 5 years. It taught me how to be a champion. It taught me that the necessary sacrifices that I needed to make on and off the field to make sure I had success on Saturdays. And one thing a lot of people don't understand about the Miami Hurricanes, a lot of times they saw us on TV, you know, dancing and clowning around or whatever. But the fact is that from Monday to Friday, we put the time in on the football field. Some of the hardest games I played at the University of Miami were at practice. I mean, practice was intense. We were going at each other like there was a game every Saturday. And the competition level was so high at the University of Miami that if you were able to get on the field and start, you earned it. No, nothing was given to you. So I knew that playing for a team like that, having the success that I had at the University of Miami, going to the next level, I was prepared to win. And I had that winning mentality. And I like to think that a lot of me getting drafted by Kiowa in the first round and being his first pick overall in his career as a head coach had a lot to do with the fact that I had come from a program where I was a champion. And he wanted me to bring that mentality, that championship aura, you know, a good part to the Steelers. So I was very blessed to be chosen by him and playing for the Steelers for those years that I played for.
Yeah, so thinking about Coach Cower, what did he teach you with the Steelers? Meaning not, I guess, about the game of football, but more of the game of life. I guess I'm sure that you learned lessons, especially, you know, coming straight from college to the pros, and you're a young man at that point in time, you know, just learning life, and now you're given all this money and your specific things, and you're with a winning football team, but the NFL is so much different than college. What did Coach Cower do? Because it seemed like Coach Cower was a very good mentor. You guys wanted to play for Coach Cower because he motivated you to want to win. It's like you had a guy that literally cared for the players, it sounds like, from what you're saying about Coach Cower.
Well, he did. I mean, everything about Coach Cower, I had already exuded coming from the University of Miami. You know, he wanted guys that were tough to put the work in throughout the week and play hard on Sundays. I mean, you know, just in general, as life goes, most of my mentors were guys on the team. You know, only time I really didn't have any in-depth conversations with Coach Cower.
Oh, really?
outside of game planning or the stuff we needed to do on Sunday. So if anything pertained to life in general, it really came from the mentorships and the relationships that I had with guys on the team.
The players from that team. And again, you guys in the 90s set up for how great the 2000s were. I've talked to different people about that, and that's the real truth, isn't it? Yep. You guys were the people who led to the success of 2000s, building back the Steeler tradition, the 90s teams that you were on with the Steelers, I believe, for sure.
Well, you know, that tradition of being a Steeler, you know, went way before we did. I mean, that whole mentality in the 70s with all the success that they had, we were just trying to bring that back. You know,
you guys brought it back. That's what's the great thing.
Well, we like to think we did bring it back. We brought back that Steeler aura. There was a period of time, maybe in the 80s, where the Steelers, you know, didn't have as much success as they did in the 90s. But, you know, it still stems back to the fact that those great teams in the 70s, we just wanted to bring that mentality back, that hard-nosed defense, that running the football, playing for 60 minutes. I mean, we just wanted to bring that aura back to the Steel Town because we figured that the fans deserved it.
Yeah, and definitely. And the fans were unlike any other fans, weren't they, Leon? How crazy people were about their Steelers in Pittsburgh, for sure.
Well, you know, some of my greatest experiences as a football player were just driving to the stadium on Sundays. I used to call it Steeler Row because you would drive and be about a mile out of the stadium, and there would be people tailgating and waving terrible towels and saying, "Here we go, Steelers." And if they recognized you in your car, they'd run to your car and sing, "Here we go, Steelers," and wave their terrible towels, and you can smell the Brock's cooking and the meat on the grill. And I mean, I love playing for that type of environment because it reminds me a lot of college when I played at University of Miami. It reminded me of that same mentality where the fans in Miami love their Hurricanes, and it was the same. I could say the same thing about the Steelers fans. I mean, they love their Pittsburgh Steelers.
What was your greatest moment playing for the Steelers? What would you say? Like the greatest memory of playing for the Steelers?
My greatest moment of playing for the Steelers is probably in the championship game where we had the opportunity. We played the Colts, and I can't remember who batted that ball down, but to this day, that football was staying in the air for at least 20 seconds. I mean, I didn't count it, but when they did, I can't remember who batted the ball down and it was incomplete, but just that. Just feeling that stadium rock and roll when we had an opportunity to go play in the Super Bowl. That has to be my greatest experience as a Pittsburgh Steeler. You know, getting back to the Super Bowl in that year, in 1995, getting an opportunity to play in the Super Bowl.
I remember that game very well as well, watching it in Arkansas when I was a professional wrestler, Leon. So I was in someone's house and we were watching the game come back. I'm like, oh my gosh, the Colts came back. What? Because we all remember how disappointing Buffalo was the year before. And then to see this happen and say, yes, finally, we're back to the Super Bowl. And it was definitely one of my favorite teams of all time, Steeler teams. Even though you never won the Super Bowl, you guys played one of the greatest teams of all time in the Super Bowl, Dallas Cowboys, and you really held your own for most of that game. It's very close, for sure.
Well, I don't know how great they were, especially in that Super Bowl. Hell, if we hadn't had two turnovers, that would have been a cakewalk. Our defense, if you look at it statistically, our defense held the mighty Dallas Cowboys offense to like 125 yards of total offense. Emmitt Smith barely had 40 yards rushing.
That's true, yeah.
Offensively, we had amassed somewhere to 380 to 390 yards of total offense against that so-called great defense. So, if we had played mistake-free football, that game wouldn't have been as close as it was. And we just literally gave them a Super Bowl by throwing two interceptions inside the red zone. So we put our defense backs against the wall because literally throughout the whole game, our defense was annihilating that so-called Dallas Cowboys powerhouse offense. So,
okay.
I mean, that's still a stickler. I mean, I see guys today that played at the University of Miami were actually on that team, and I see their rings, and it still stomachs me to know that we had lost that game.
And you're right. Some of your teammates on the Dallas Cowboys, for sure, that you played on that Miami team. You said this, we're going to beat you. But I think when I say great teams, if you look historically on paper, the Cowboys were favored by, I think, 10 points against you guys. They thought it was going to be another one of those blowout Super Bowls like we saw the NFC beat the AFC. And you're right. I don't want to talk about the turnovers, Leon, because that still eats at me as well, because I really believed it. One of my friends that played and wrestled in the WWE, the Headbangers, were huge Dallas Cowboy fans. I'm in the locker room with them and said, there's no chance that your boys are going to win the Steelers. I said, yes, they are. They're going to win. And I was in, I think it was in Indiana. I was talking to them. And so one of them was a huge Cowboy fan. And I'm like, just front runners. But we were close, very close. And I guess it eats at you guys. Anytime you lose the Super Bowl, as amazing as the Super Bowl is, it never leaves you, right? Every time you start talking about it again, you start thinking about, oh, if this play would have gone this way, we would be Super Bowl champs.
Well, I have like a 364-day day off when it comes to the Super Bowl. But, you know, every time the Super Bowl comes around, you know, they always have an opportunity to flashback. You know how they flashback all the Super Bowls and they show with highlights of them. So, for some reason, while I'm looking through the channel, I always catch the Steeler Cowboy in Super Bowl 30 for some reason. And it's still hard to watch because, you know, that's just one game that we let get away. And like I said, if it wasn't for those turnovers, I think I would have a shiny ring on my finger right now. Because I don't even wear my AFC championship ring. I won't wear it. I refuse to wear it. I gave it to my father.
Okay. Well, I guess that's what it is for sure. Winning is everything in certain ways. And then at least you had all those national championships with Miami. So, Leon, you ended up playing more years in the NFL after leaving the Steelers. But again, I'm going to keep my focus and attention on what I'm interested in. But really, I'm interested in your story afterwards. The reason is just because I've been reading up on it and specific things and talking about life after football. And we really have to bring up these things. And I'm about educating people and whatever types of things. But if I get my opportunity to talk Steeler football and talk about one of my, I don't consider it childhood, but Leon, how old were we when you were in the Super Bowl? Because we're the same age. We're both 42, if I'm correct. And so we were about the same.
I'm 40.
How old do you know?
I'm 45.
45. Okay. And Wikipedia's wrong. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Wikipedia's wrong. So you're 3 years older than me when you were in the Super Bowl. So we were both pretty young at that time, seeing that disappointment for sure. Now, after your career, you play for the Jaguars and you play a couple more years in the NFL. Your career ends. Mm-hmm. And did you have a plan, Leon, after you retired? Did you have that plan? Because that's the key point is life after football. I've talked to so many different people. Did you have that plan?
Well, listen, there's a statistic out there where, you know, former players 2 years after they have played in the NFL, 78% of them either are in financial turmoil or go bankrupt. No, I can't say all guys have plans. I mean, me, essentially, I didn't have a plan. I mean, I felt that I was indestructible while I played, and I thought the same thing once my career was over in football. And when you amass debt, you make poor decisions in life, things happen. There things happen that are unfortunate, and you learn from them. And I'm 10 years removed from that. I'm doing much better now.
That's good.
And that's the reason why I mentor the kids. I talk to kids. I mentor the high school and college kids online, on the field. Just talk about them. Not only do I train them and coach them, but I mentor them. I mentor them about making the right decisions, making the right choices in life, about making business decisions, about some of the lures and traps that
yes.
people that stage for these athletes when they come into the league, men and women, financial advisors, agents, people that want you to invest, people, your family members that all of a sudden can't work because now you're making all this, amassing all this money. I tell these guys that, look, you know, put yourself on a salary. You've got to prepare for life. You've got to prepare like football is that your next game will be your last game.
Right.
And I just tell the guys that. And I used this opportunity. I used my experiences as an opportunity to enlighten kids, to prepare kids. And would I change one thing about it? No, because I know now that through all the hardship and the turmoil that I've come out of, now I'm going to use that as an opportunity and a tool to enlighten kids and prepare kids so that they don't have to go down the road that I had to travel.
And that's the reason. A lot of times things happen to us so we can finally make a difference through those tough times and trials and be able to mentor and talk to kids and talk to people about those mistakes. And when you look back at it, you think that there's enough money out there forever. And then everybody comes out with a handout, everyone this, and money disappears quickly. And especially with such a short career.
Well,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't disappear. You know what you do with it.
Right. It disappears. But meaning,
you know what you do with it.
Yeah,
hey, listen, the NFL lifestyle is very addictive. Okay? It's very addictive. You know, everything's VIP. Everybody, you know, you've got a lot of yes men and women around you. You've got women throwing themselves at you. You've got investors who try to sell you ice, you know, ice in the North Pole. You've got agents who love you to death, but once your career is over, you know, don't accept your phone calls. You've got family members who you know, your life that worked all their life, all of a sudden they can't pay a bill here, can't pay a bill there. You're going to nightclubs, you're going to strip clubs, you're buying everyone dinner, you're taking everybody on vacations. The bill's on you. And the quintessential word I tell kids to say when they don't feel comfortable with doing something, I tell them, you've got to learn to say no. You've got to learn to say no. You got to learn to say no to investors. You got to learn to say no to financial guys. You got to learn to say no to women. You got to learn to say no to family, even your own mom. It's going to come at a point in time where you've got to say enough is enough. And if you're married and you have children, you got to look at their future and their well-being. And I just tell guys to, once you get all the, you know, the spending, you need to put yourself on a salary. Put yourself on an allowance every month and say, if this runs out, then that's it. And I tell guys that because a lot of kids in high school, and I've coached high school, I've coached at the college level, all these kids have these dreams and aspirations of playing in the NFL. And I ask them each and every day, are you prepared for what the tidal wave that's coming at you? And, of course, they say, oh, yeah, I can handle it, this and that. But they have no idea. There's got to be a preparation when you go to the next level because you're going to have vultures coming at you all directions. You've got to be prepared for it.
And when you talked about, and that's very interesting, you talked about the NFL lifestyle. I think lifestyle in general, when you have money, you gotta spend the money. And that's what society shows you. Okay, well, if you have this money, then live the lifestyle that you're living while you're making that salary, and everyone lives above that salary in certain ways. So they
here's the thing that a lot of people don't understand is that in order to be great and play on at the NFL level, there's got to be a sense of arrogance and egotistic. There's a sense of arrogance, and a lot of guys are egotistical when they play for just to get out on that field and perform at a certain level each and every Sunday. So a lot of that arrogance and a lot of that ego carries over off the field, because when you're on the field, you want the spotlight, you want to do well, you want to have success, you want the fans to cheer, you want to make big plays. That and sometimes that carries off the field. You want the attention, you want the women attention, you want the people looking at it. Well, you want people to see you driving nice, looking good, shining, blinging, popping bottles, doing this, this, and that. And a lot of guys don't know how to differentiate the two between on the field and off the field. And that's where a lot of the guys have the problems. When 78%, like the statistic I said earlier, when close to 80% of the guys on the team are in financial turmoil or go bankrupt after 2 years from playing in the NFL, that's a problem. That's a serious problem that needs to be addressed. And the NFL they're doing better, but there needs to be more former guys like myself who can mentor a lot of these young men that are going into the NFL. Yes. And a lot of them listen and a lot of them don't, because a lot of them, once they get that check in their hand, they're driving nice and they're flashing and dashing, they don't think it could happen to them.
Right.
I've seen it happen to a lot of guys. Shoot, it happened to me. So, you want these guys to learn from the mistakes of other guys that came before.
You have this ego, and then the expenses, think about how much you guys spend on the road during a season. And that's where expenses can go up for anyone, business traveling or traveling in general, and specifically always on the move, that you can't just say, okay, as a professional athlete, you're training all the time, you're eating all the time. There's so many different things that you have to have things set up for you. You have to have specific things how expensive everything gets, for sure, and to live that lifestyle. But at least you're going to go and try to mentor some of them, and some will listen, some won't, but you'll really help some people that really just don't understand and needed somebody
Well, I mean, I'm glad you're giving me this platform and opportunity to showcase one of my companies that I have out there is called Real Men Block. I mean, it's a t-shirt line, an apparel line. It has patent pending equipment to help offensive linemen out. The website is up, but one of the things that my company does provide on the website, where up and coming offensive linemen can come and interact with guys who played the game. And not only do the guys provide advice on training, how to block guys and diet and nutrition, but they also offer the guys advice, they're life coaches to a lot of these.
That's great.
To a lot of these players. A lot of these kids that play high school or play at Division One or Division Two, you know, they're able to interact with guys who played it at the highest level to give them advice on, you know, agents and financing and what, and, you know, some of the entrapment. So that's one of the packages that I have with my company, where I know a lot of guys who played, who coach, and it gives these kids an opportunity to get, you know, advice on life in general. So a lot of these kids listen. A lot of them don't. Unfortunately, I would like that statistic of 80% to go down, and I hope that it does. But until we get more former guys interacting with younger guys as far as mentoring and these guys listening and making right choices, the statistic is either going to go up or go down, and I would like to see go down. I would just like to see young men make better decisions and better choices when it comes to their lives.
Definitely, and I'm glad, again, you're making a difference. I'm glad, definitely, you got to tell us about the website at the end as well, Leon, because, again, that's so important to have the ability to help these kids, because now this has become a big business. Everyone's told they're going to be the next professional athlete, the next college star, the next everything, and they need someone like yourself, Leon, to tell them, hey, you might not be, and here's how we're going to help you try to get to that level, But, you know, everyone's going to tell you the world that you're going to be the greatest thing ever, and then they forget about their grades, or they forget about specifically looking at other options and things like that, and they pick a school that they never play at, or different things by your company and able to kind of guide these men and young student athletes to their meeting their goals and needs. It's become such a big business. Think about high school sports in general and middle school sports when you're talking football, and how all these different clinics and all these different things, it's just become a huge big business, and they need that guidance for sure.
Absolutely. You hit the hammer on the nail. Absolutely. A lot of these kids just need guidance. They just need, you know, a lot of these kids just need, you know. One thing I do recognize about sports nowadays is that a lot of these kids feel entitled, and you know they've been glamorized, you know, ever since they were in Pop Warner, and you just got to be real with them. You got to tell them the truth. You got to tell them about the perils that lie ahead, and if they listen, and you hope they listen, and you hope they make the right choices. So that's my calling. That's what my company is about. Real Men Block, and I just enjoy. I enjoy coaching. I enjoy mentoring. It's been a blessing for me.
Well, we need to stay in touch for sure. We can work together in specific ways. I'm looking to create some webinars for ACT and SAT prep and different things like that, and how important it is leading these kids to get the right scores to get into their schools so they don't become academic ineligible. So I know you see me on Facebook. I see you on Facebook. We'll definitely stay in touch. But where's the best place we can find information on you, Leon, and learn more about you? Where can we go for your business?
Well, I'm on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, but my name of my company is Real Men Block. The website is it's under construction right now. The website is realmenblock.biz. That's realmenblock.biz, all lowercase. And I'm working on a book that kind of tells, you know, I'm working on children's books. I've got a lot of projects going on right now. Everything is centered around mentoring and enlightening young men to make better choices with the decisions they make in life. So that's my calling. That's what I enjoy doing. So I'm blessed to have the opportunity each and every day.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show. Any way I can help you out and all the different things that I do with some of my companies and things like that to help you reach your goals and aspirations, to help mentor young men, I'm here for you, man. So anytime you need to come on the show to promote something, feel free to just reach out to me, okay?
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
All right, take care, Leon. See you later. Okay, bye-bye.
You got it.
Yeah, bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, Total Tutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And wow, did I get feedback for the Davin Joseph show, the first segment that we had together. And so I'm excited to have him back on again to talk now about the offseason. We talked about the NFL draft the last time. Now we're going to talk about offseason, what he does during the offseason. I'm excited to welcome the program to time Pro Bowl foundation. He is the founder of Davin's Dream Team, Davin Joseph from the St. Louis Rams. Davin, thanks for calling. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, sir. How you doing?
Doing fantastic. And the offseason, it's an interesting thing, right? Once you put all that effort into the whole entire season, and then you get to that point where it's time for a break. It takes time to kind of transition yourself, isn't it? Saying, okay, now it's a different mode. I have to kind of structure myself differently and stuff. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, it is, because then you have the balance in that of going from football being the number one priority to being now is family. Then you got some friends, and you have your own special interests, and then of course. A little bit of me time, and so trying to balance it all is the art of the off season. And we see some people do it very well, some people do not so great of a job.
And because you have your foundation, Davin, that really your off season is less of an off season, because you're pretty much it's one of your full time jobs, your foundation. So when you have less time, you have more time. You know, you're training, you're seeing family, but now you have more time to focus on the foundation at that time for sure, right?
Exactly. A lot of preparation to getting it ready for the season, really having an NFL platform having that momentum of the NFL season, you want to kind of use that as leverage for getting the word out with the foundation. And so a lot of the prep work goes into around these months right now, May into June, prepping for the season. And then during the season, you're prepping for the off season, being able to, you know, make all the charity functions, whether it's a golf tournament, whether it's a gala, just kind of setting your agenda to, you know, hit some hot spots, do some networking, of course, a little fundraising. And so it's a year-round gig, but a lot of this stuff's really focused in the off season.
It definitely is, for sure. And in that process, working together with people that are involved in your foundation, you have a little bit more time to sit down and meet with them and talk about your goals for the year, right? That's this time of the season, off season's a time to kind of gear up yourself and work with your foundation team together to make sure that you set the goals you want for the year, right?
Oh, yeah, and sometimes I think they like me when it's the off-season. Sometimes I think they don't like me because I have a lot of demands. And so, you know, it's trying to get them all done in that short time period. I know my executive director, Angel Williams, she doesn't like it sometimes when I get on the roll of really spinning up all these thoughts. She makes her job a little harder. But then when the season comes, it's almost like I'm just really, really quiet. You just, you know, really focusing on football and whatnot, and it's hard to get a lot out of me. So, you know, it's consistent work, but it's fun, though. It's fun at the end of the day.
And that's the important thing. It's got to be fun, right? Right, Davin, if it's not fun, then you're going to get, it's not going to be your passion. And this is truly your passion. And that's what kind of drives you in so many ways to put things around. And do you feel at times, because I consider people have their own foundations, they're entrepreneurs, to have that entrepreneurial mindset, you're already transitioning yourself ready for life after football, for sure, because you're really learning specifically the dealings of business, the dealings with, you know, with donors, the dealing with the everyday odds and ends throughout the season, that you constantly are learning how to develop yourself professionally, for sure.
It's hands-on training. It's really hands-on training. And so, you know, I have my really good days and some really bad days. But the goal is to learn from all of them. And so running a nonprofit, trying to prepare and, of course, look at budgets, look at expenditures, trying to, you know, cut what you can and add what you can. And I think some people get that notion of set up a nonprofit, apply for some grants, do a little begging, and it works, and it just doesn't. And so it's really about coming with a business model of how can you separate yourself from the rest of the pack? What can you do that's different? Here's your impact, really good. You know, what's your feedback like? What do the people in the community say about you? What can you do to get better? So you're always, you know, looking back at yourself, just like a normal business would, just like we see these surveys and whatnot when you go to the hotel. We do the same thing. You know, we're surveying all the time, always looking for feedback, always looking at how can we improve, and, of course, new ideas. In the nonprofit world, you always have to be on the up and up with those new creative ways to raise the funds without necessarily action and creating relationships. And so it's time-consuming, but at the end of the day, to help some people that need help, it's all worth it.
And that's so important. And then when you talk about family life, trying to get together with friends and family during this time, it's nice to have that, right? Because your schedule's so, you know, booked solid throughout the season that this is the time you can lay back, relax, have your me time, different things like that. Let's talk a little bit first before family life about me time, Davin. What types of me time stuff do you do in the off season?
You know, me time is always trying to go somewhere new. You know, my thing is traveling. I'm not a car guy. I don't really care much about clothes. I think I got the same. I got on some sweatpants right now. I've probably had since 2006. but it's still good. And they don't stink. So, I'm not into jewelry. I'm not into anything else but traveling. And so, for me to hit a couple of new destinations a year is always a plus. And so when it comes to Davin and me time, it's always about going somewhere new, learning something new, and trying to do that whole, you know, learning, growing experience and I'm trying to put a little giving back in it also, while also having a good time and enjoying it either with people that I meet on the trip or people that I knew, you know, what I went on a trip with, so I've known already. So that's me time. That's what I love to do.
So what types of places do you like to travel? Where do you travel in the off season? Too.
Most recently, I went to Jamaica with a really good friend of mine, Donald Penn. He plays for the Oakland Raiders. And it was probably about a group of eight of us went to Jamaica for about 4 days and really had a great time. You know, we did the Negril thing and got over to Ocho Rios a little bit and went to a fabulous festival. And it was just a good time. It was a good time. And it was right after the season, so it was kind of like that. That relaxation trip. Don't really do much, just relaxing, sleeping in, probably staying up too late, but, you know, just having just good, easy fun. But most recently, I actually went up to Washington, D.C. in Baltimore to the Preakness Horse Race.
Really?
It wasn't new, but it was a trip I really loved and enjoyed. Something I can do with my family, because my son and my mom and some relatives of mine really love horse racing. And so that was just an easy trip. Good direct flight up there, stayed right there in D.C., did some, you know, D.C. stuff, and went over to the race Saturday, came back Sunday, and it was nice and easy. And so that type of stuff. But that's usually kind of how I like to do it, simple, easy trips.
Interesting when you said you went to the Preakness. How crazy of an atmosphere is it for an event like that?
Really, I haven't been to the Derby, and I know everybody says that's like the Mecca of all races.
I could see you at one point, Davin, going to the Derby. I really do. If you're a horse racing fan, you'll be there someday, for sure.
Yeah. Amanda doesn't know yet, and for people who don't know who Amanda is, she's over at EAG. Look her up. She's awesome. But she doesn't know that she's setting me up next year for the Kentucky Derby. But the atmosphere there, it's a Baltimore thing. So you really see a lot of people that are from Baltimore, born and raised, that come back for the race. And they have this infield that's just full of tents and, of course, full of people and full of things to do. And so before you know it, you kind of forget that you're at a horse race just because the environment is so social, so friendly, so interactive. And it's just a great event to be around. But when that Preakness race runs, it is everybody's in it. The preliminaries, races, and all that stuff, you know, people are in it, but not in it for that race. You know, everybody's watching. And it was just an awesome, awesome experience.
Can you give us a horse race prediction? You think we're going to see our Triple Crown winner? What's your take on that?
Man, if we ever had a chance to really get a Triple Crown winner, I think it would be this year. American Pharoah, I believe that's his name.
Yeah.
The way he looked last weekend was amazing. You know, led out the gate, ran strong the entire time, and it just looked like he was. You know, you can see sometimes, even when like the runner runs, they're just kind of like jogging when everybody else is just like sprinting. It looks like they're jogging. That's how it was watching that horse. It was just seemed like such an easy race. It seemed like the horse just never got tired and was just at the same pace the entire time. And so I believe we got a real chance because I don't know if that horse really even ran as hard as that. And that's the crazy part.
Definitely, for sure. Now, Davin, I understand this time in the off season you have some big events coming up too. You'd like to talk about, right? Some events coming.
You know, we have a couple.
Yeah,
we have a couple coming up. We have the relaunching of the Atlas Dream Team website coming up mid June. That should be. We're trying to put a little something on to highlight it, but it's really good coming from my side because, of course, everything's about getting the message out nice, clean, and clear. And took a lot of time in the off season to really look at the site, get some feedback on the site, get the site, take it down, get it back up the right way. And so I'm excited about that. We have some free physicals coming up over the summertime in July, mid-July, down in the South Florida area, and also down up in Tampa, where we're partnering with D1 over in Tampa Bay to get free physicals for high school athletes in the area that participate in sports. And so that's going to be a fun event coming up. And we're working on a couple other things, and we'll see how they'll pan out. But right now, those are things we have set in stone that'll be exciting. And last but not least, we have a partnership with Samaritan Feet to give out some shoes for going back to school this coming up summer. Haven't set the date yet, haven't set the location, but did a similar event last year that really turned out to be, you know, a lot better than I ever imagined, and the impact was just tremendous.
Wow, and definitely some cool things coming up for you, Davin, and really interesting to know about the off season. We'll have to figure out some of the interesting things we'll be talking about soon. When do you have to? Now, I know that the season's kind of like training camps starts in how many months is training camp? When does training camp begin for you guys?
Training camp's not till late July.
Late July.
To get back in the swing of things, and that's when the schedule gets a little busy. And so late July, early mid-August, it gets a little tight. And so just trying to do as much stuff as we can before that comes up. Of course, the kids are coming up on summer vacation, and they have plans to do something, and so we got to figure that one out too. And so just trying to have a little fun in the summer before I got to get back to the major work.
All right. Well, Davin, where's the best place we can find information on you, learn more about you? Where can we go?
You know, it's always davinsdreamteam.org. Join the team. We're going to have a new campaign coming up that people will be able to read about, and even some ways that people can join the team just for minimal money per month. I think it's the lowest, like a dollar. And I think it's going to be an exciting year coming up, but log on to davinsdreamteam.org to find out more information.
Well, Davin, thanks for calling the program. Best of luck with everything, and enjoy your off season. There's definitely a lot of summer to go, so take care.
Yeah, exactly. Appreciate you, Neil. Talk to you soon.
All right, you too. All right, take care, Davin. See you later. Bye-bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, Davin Joseph segment, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Toll Education Network. Again, tolltutor.net for more information. Twitter, tolltutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, tolltutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. And I love working with Triumph Books because I get to talk sports, which I love. And you say, an educator loves sports? Well, hey, it's my favorite thing. If I would have time to watch sports all the time, I would. But I am busy with so many different things. But I'm excited to welcome the program. Author of Big Numbers Don't Lie, the biggest numbers in New York Mets history by Russ Cohen and Adam Rader. Russ, thanks for calling, and how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. And Russ, I tell you what, when I think the New York Mets, and I talked about this before, it's that 1986 team. It's just because I guess because I was born in 73, that's the team I can really remember. We'll talk, I'm sure, about a couple other Mets as well. But I'm sure that when you run into Mets fans, especially, I guess, this generation, I mean, Mets fans from, you know, probably their 60s to 30s, they talk about that 1986 team, don't they? For sure.
Yeah, Neil, they do. I mean, it's an iconic team. They did have that great season. They would have like 108 wins. They really ran away with it. I think the second place Phillies were like 20 games out. I mean, it's just they fought, right? There were a lot of fights. They had the Gillies fight. They had everything. They had pitching. They had hitting. They had great fielding, and they had a lot of charisma. And so everybody sort of remembers them, whether you love Keith Hernandez for his great fielding and clutch hitting, or Gary Carter for the big home runs, or, you know, Ray Knight for the punch that he threw at Eric Davis when he was on third base, whatever it is.
I mean, just think about it. From Strawberry, watching Strawberry's career going up to the 86, looking at Dwight Gooden. I mean, the who's who names of baseball that everyone's, and then thinking about against the Sox, beating the Boston Red Sox, and what a World Series. I mean, I'm sure that when you're doing book signings, they're talking about this, reminiscing about this 86 team, and saying, when are the Mets going to be back like this again, right? For sure.
Yeah, and, you know, right now they're in that in-between stage. They're more like where they were in about 83,
I agree,
think.
Yeah.
And so they're getting closer. You know, the pitching is there. The hitting's not quite there. And so that's where, you know, you have to sort of live with it and say, okay, look, I know they may not stay in first place, and right now they're in second, but at least we could see that there's some hope.
Definitely some hope, and you have certain people that are characters starting to become for those Mets for sure. Now, thinking about, you know, other things, we talked about Strawberry, we talk about different people, but looking at the Mets, I guess the rich history from 62 on, what would you say would be that Met you would talk about all the time before the 86? What Met would you name as, hey, if we're not talking about the 86 team, we're not talking the 80s of Mets, who would you say would be that iconic figure you want to talk about?
Well, it would be Tom Seaver. I mean, he was my favorite player growing up, and I try not to get too crazy about talking about him, because if you went up and checked out my man cave, there's quite a shrine to him. And I used to be a pitcher for a while in Little League, and so I would, you know, try and copy him. And the guy, you know, I could basically go to, back in the day, I could go to, like, it was called Abraham and Strauss, A&F, and they had, like, the first Ticketron, and I would tell my mother, I would just count out, you know, every fifth day and say, you can get tickets for this game or this game or this. And I basically, the guy would never get injured until, like, way into his career. And I could see every one of his starts, or at least the ones my parents would pay for. So I have to say it was Seaver. I mean, he won 25 games in 69. He was the huge reason they got back on track. You know, when he was a rookie, it was a big deal, even though some would say, oh, well, he only won 16 games. That was huge. And winning Rookie of the Year was huge. And so I don't think there's any more iconic to the Mets than Tom Seaver, or ever will be, really, to be honest.
I agree. And you think of Seaver and you think of that, and for sure. And it's interesting because we're looking at dates from 62 to now, the present. The 80s weren't that far from gone from 62. So looking at those rich years. But you know what I tell you when I talk about the Mets, and when I got to see Fernando Valenzuela pitch at Shea Stadium when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And Shea Stadium, I really thought it was an iconic ballpark, just because you think about the subways and the different things before we built all those old fashioned ballparks. Right. And I'm sure that you talk about Shea in the book for sure. Right.
Yeah, no, we do. And there's actually a little tribute to Shea, things we loved about it, things we hated about it. I always hated the escalators because they were always turned off. We always had a walk, and I was a little kid, and Shea was just a beat. You know, if you had to sit in the upper level, it just seemed like it took 3 miles to walk up there. But, you know, as far as Fernando goes, I remember in 85 or 86, I think it was 86, that, you know, most times you can go up, walk up to a Met game, scalp, do whatever, and Gooden was pitching against them, and you absolutely couldn't get a ticket. And it was one of the few times I actually got turned away at Shea and just couldn't get a ticket. And so I would agree with you. There were some, you know, he when he was there and he was on, no matter who he was pitching against, he was worth watching. And then if he was against a good one, then you just elevated it.
I forget when. I think I saw Fernando probably his second year, because I was a huge Dodger fan because my uncle was a Dodger fan. And I'm not a Dodger fan anymore, trust me. They try to recruit me at times when the Pirates aren't very good. But, hey, I'm back in the Pirate fold again, maybe. Again, like I said, you know, this is not looking good so far this year, to say the least.
It's
early. Exactly. And you know what I found fascinating? So I'm so glad I watched this ESPN special, so I have a little bit more knowledge to talk about the Mets now. I never heard of David Wright till I watched this ESPN special. But He interests me so much after that. I can't wait to watch him pitch at one point when I get a chance, you know, and to read up more about it, because he really...
Wait, you mean Matt Harvey?
Matt Harvey. Oh, my gosh. Why did I say David Wright? Matt Harvey. I apologize. Matt Harvey.
That's okay.
Yeah. Just the unbelievable thinking about Matt Harvey, right? I mean, go ahead.
I saw him pitch in his rookie year. My best friend and I went on a little tour of, you know, some stadiums, and I had been to PNC before, but he hadn't. So we went to PNC, and then we went to Great American Ballpark. And Harvey was starting a game at Great American Ballpark in his first year, and it was middle of the summer. It was like August, and we go there, and we get to watch this guy warm up live, and over in Cincy, you could look over the bullpen and the ball was just popping, right? And I hadn't heard the ball pop like that really since Gooden. And so that was unbelievable. And then he's pitching and he gets a double. He helps drive in a run and it's raining and the guy's staying in. And even the rain didn't bother him, right? It was just nothing mattered to this guy. He was all business. Then when he came out of the game, it became a little bit of an adventure, but John Roush ended up getting the save, and it all worked out. But it was just like at that point I knew, and look, he didn't win Rookie of the Year or anything. He won like 9 games in his first season. But I knew then this guy was special. And look, we'd heard about him a little bit, but it was good to see him live.
And it's, when you talk about Matt Harvey, he seems like he could be part of that 86 team if you brought him back in the time machine or something.
Just oh, yeah. I mean, he would fit right in. Absolutely.
What I thought about when I think about Matt Harvey is I think about specifically enough, how's he doing this season? Just by the way, for our listeners out there that might not know much about Matt Harvey.
He's doing great. He might be the best pitcher in baseball. He's 5-1. He's got a 1.98 ERA. He's killing it.
So it sounds like, Rush, you're a Mets fan, right? Even though you covered him. Did you cover him for years before?
No, I covered the Phillies for a few years, but I'm a Mets fan through and through. I have a Mets tattoo. I've been to 27 straight home openers, and I've been to more than that. So that just happens to be my streak currently. And so, yeah, I'm a huge Mets fan. There's no hiding it.
And then finally, you think they're back. So I'm glad you said you think they're back. What would you say a team, and we talked about the 86, we're talking about the current team, we talk about Shea Stadium. What's another memory of the Mets that you think about in your historic career of thinking about the Mets as a fan?
Well, you know, there's so many things. You know, the post 9/11 Piazza homer, everybody was watching that game, I think. I think everybody in the United States was watching that, and that was great. The grand single by Robin Ventura against the Braves, the hated Braves, you know, that was a pretty big deal. There were so many moments. I went to the 1983 home opener. I had to walk like a half a mile just to get into the stadium because it was so sold out because Tom Seaver was back in the fold. They got him back, and he was starting against Steve Carlton. It was an unbelievable game. So that was, you know, so there's things like that. And there's a lot of them. Unfortunately, Citi Field has a few memories, but nothing close. And maybe, you know, over time, they'll get better memories. But right now, it's not even close.
And think about I remember the Mets on the road and how they were like rock stars for years, even after the 86 team, and how they always would beat the Pirates. Oh, and the Pirates were finally trying to get close to taking down the Mets. I remember that. So I always will have some sort of hatred for the Mets, Russ. So, because you remember when they were in the same division together? That was pretty interesting.
Of course. I mean, look, Willie Stargell had a star. He had one of the longer home runs in Shea Stadium history, and they put a star on the seed, if I remember correctly. I was a kid when that happened. But actually, Harry Johnson wrote the foreword, and he talked about one of the most memorable homers he ever hit was in June of 88, and it was in Three Rivers. And I'm trying to see who the pitcher was.
I think I was at the game.
Now Jim Gott.
Okay, I remember it, yes, because we were really thinking these Pirates in the 80s were going to do something. And
He said they won the game 8-7 in the 10th inning, and he loved the fact that he silenced the crowd. And so that's something where, unfortunately, you probably weren't very happy that day, but it is a great moment.
Yeah, you're not going to. So we'll have to see if ever there'll be a rivalry again, the Mets and the Pirates. Aren't they playing? I think they have a series this weekend.
I think they do have this weekend. I got to see Mets-Pirates in between the Stanley Cup when the Penguins were last in it, and some nice Pirates fans who were upset with the ownership at that point, and you had just gotten rid of, the outfielder. He was a really good player. And everybody was upset, and I went and watched the game, and actually it was Andrew McCutchen's first game, and he hit like 2 triples, I think, or at least 1 triple, and he killed the Mets in that game. And I was like, wow, this McCutchen guy is unbelievable. So that's what I took away from that game. Besides the ballpark being just beautiful, you know.
All right, so Russ, where's the best place we can find information on you, purchase your book, and learn more about you? Where can we go?
You can go to Amazon.com. You can go to Sportsology.com. I'll definitely have some information up there. The book is due out June 1st in Barnes & Noble, so if you want to wait for that Barnes & Noble hit, then June 1st.
All right, well, thanks again for calling the program, Russ. Best of luck to you, and thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks to you, Neil.
All right, take care. Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Spotlight Show on the Toll Education Network. Again, tolltutor.net for more information. Twitter, Toll Tutor. Neil S. Haley, Facebook. LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, Toll Tutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And always very interesting to have interesting authors, entrepreneurs. I think everything in between, philanthropists. This is our guest. So I'm excited to welcome the program. New York Times bestselling author was ranked by Forbes ranked as the world's most powerful woman in 2011 and 2012. Sherry Harrison. Sherry, how are you? And thanks for calling.
I'm good. How are you? Thank you.
I'm doing fantastic. And it's quite interesting to look at your whole career as an entrepreneur and all these things and see all the amazing things you've done. Isn't it great to look back at times?
Thank you. Yes, it is. It's quite amazing. It's been a journey.
One of those kind of journeys for sure. Now, today our topic, we're going to talk about the doing good model and how it's been successful as for you as an entrepreneur. And a lot of times it's something that lots of entrepreneurs think it, you know, when they think business, they think numbers. They think specifically enough how I can get ahead is the best thing. And not looking at all the people around them, who their employees are going to be, who the people that they're going to interact as with their clients and all that. There's all these components to being successful in business, isn't it?
Yes, but I really believe that when you connect to values and the doing good model, activate your goodness in business is about value-based business. And I believe that when you concentrate on values, it always comes back, and it's a win-win. It comes back financially, and it's a win-win for society, for humanity, and the environment as a whole.
Well, definitely. I think because, again, the situation is that you are transforming people's lives, from your employees to people that you work with to others that truly are in need. When you have success as an entrepreneur, that you really have to look at what value you're bringing to your position, correct? For sure.
Exactly. I think, you know, any business, if you're a small business, then, you know, it's your employees and your clients and the people in your area. We as a global business, the Harrison Group, we're in 40 different countries, 5 continents. We have 30,000 employees. So we have major impact in everywhere that we do business, through our employees, through our clients, through, you know, the different cities and different countries that we work in. We create influential impact. So why not make that impact positive for the future of humanity and future of the globe?
So how do we teach these value-based principles? Can you share some of them for us? Because I think what's so important about it is that you hear about value, giving value. I think that's always each one of the principles come out through as value, right? The value for others.
Right.
And, yeah.
Right. Well, I think in the book there's a lot of examples of how we do it as a company, as a group, both in business and philanthropy. We give information and examples from our group, but also from businesses outside our group, from employees that moved on to other businesses and took it forward, or other people that I admire, you know, different companies that I could see that they were also value-based. So there's many different examples. But I think the most important thing is that when you talk about values in a company or as a person, it shouldn't be a plaque on the wall. It should be something that's practical, something that's measurable. I think in business, you need to have measurable outcomes. And so we take these values and we engage the employees and get them to come up with creative ideas to how to implement these values and really see them happening, see the impact that it has.
And that impact is amazing when you talk about in the 40 years of business and with the Harrison Group and how you've transformed people's lives, and you've seen specifically enough how it affects everything that you do on a daily basis to have that passion, right, Sherry? For sure.
Definitely. I mean, one value is volunteering, and we created Good Deeds Day, and we just had the 9th Good Deeds Day in March, and next year in 2016 is April 10th will be International Good Deeds Day. And from starting with a small idea that everyone can do a good deed, this past year there were 1 million people going out to do a good deed, 3 million hours of volunteering in 61 countries. It crossed all boundaries, all borders, all cultures, all ages in the school system. So it's quite amazing. You can take a value and implement it, and it just resonates outwards, and other people join in.
They definitely join in, and there's definite excitement. And then once you do good for others, it really leads to leadership. I've talked to lots of entrepreneurs that talk about service as one of the most important parts of their success. Once they're serving others and helping others, they feel that sense of doing good things. And I guess that's what that Good Deed Day is people getting together to help a cause of people that are less fortunate, and in that process, build as a team, right? Correct?
Definitely. And I think in general, you know, when you're dealing with people and employees, people want purpose in life much more than anything else. And I think that when you have a higher purpose and you're passionate and you're united in that, the energy that's created is amazing.
And that's the energy that leads to every day and what you do, because then you get to deal with your fellow co-workers and that now have a different relationship with them, understanding who they are and kind of, you know,